Sir, we are ready to go ahead with the third matter on our oral argument calendar today. We have a total of 6 cases in all. 5 of those are oral, so we're making our way. Please take some time to settle into the table and get your materials organized. I'll ask the marshal to call the third case for a record. That's right. You know what? We will take just a few additional moments. Please come in. We have some students joining us, and we appreciate always having visitors in the courtroom. And the marshal, you can take time. Don't hurry. So we'll wait while people settle in. I'll make just a few comments before appellant takes the podium, and they're probably things you already know, but I just want to remind you. Actually, I'm going to start out by welcoming the students that have joined us in the courtroom. Thank you so much for being here today. We enjoy having visitors in the courtroom, and we hope that you find the proceedings interesting. The marshal has, I'll just explain a little bit, the marshal has called at the third matter on our calendar today. We have a total of 6 matters on our calendar. 5 of those are oral, so we're about halfway through our morning. Counsel for our next case are seated at counsel table, and they're experienced to know how things proceed. I'll explain just a little bit, just as more as a matter of reminding people. Take time, counsel, as you approach the podium and adjust the microphone and the height of the podium so that you can be comfortable during our conversation. We look forward to hearing your remarks. Secondly, please let me remind you to announce your name for the record. That's for the purposes of our oral recording as well as for everyone else in the courtroom, and then to indicate who you represent in this case. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court, my name is Jessica Mers Gaddis, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Omar Muhammad. Mr. Muhammad was charged with physically and sexually assaulting CM, a vulnerable adult. While in jail, Mr. Muhammad was questioned by Tina Gullickson, a county social worker, who was required by state law to consult and coordinate with the police to investigate these allegations, to interview Mr. Muhammad, and to notify him of the results of her investigation by an official findings letter. The issues before this court are, first, was Ms. Gullickson required to give Mr. Muhammad a Miranda warning before interrogating him about these allegations? And was her official findings letter the functional equivalent of interrogation? As to the first issue, the district court found that Ms. Gullickson was not an agent of law enforcement, was not working at law enforcement's requests, and was not working in conjunction with them. Therefore, the district court concluded that Ms. Gullickson was not required to give Mr. Muhammad a Miranda warning. The district court's ruling misconstrues when a Miranda warning is required. The warning.
Can I ask you just to back up a little bit?
Sure.
So the question about whether or not Gullickson was acting as a police officer, is that a finding of fact or a finding of law, or mixed?
I guess I would answer that it occurs to me that it's probably a mixed question. But in any event, it would be the wrong question to ask. Here, although that's what the district court ultimately ruled, was that no Miranda warning was required because she was not acting as a law enforcement officer, that's not the appropriate question to ask, and that's not what this court should be focused on. Rather, the legal standard here to determine whether a Miranda warning is required is, well, let me say it this way. The warning is required by all those who use the power of the state to elicit an incriminating response from a suspect, regardless of whether they are law enforcement personnel.
So, I read the cases, though, that's not the exact question. It seems to me the question is whether or not she was acting on behalf of law enforcement.
I disagree, Your Honor.
Okay, tell me why.
Okay. So if while the state certainly presents in its brief, the state uses language from Tibiotowski, which is our Minnesota Supreme Court case that addresses not this precise issue, but this general issue. And there's language in there that uses the phrase that the juvenile services case manager in that case was not acting as a law enforcement officer. Therefore, no Miranda was required. And that's what the state's hanging its hat on for the purposes of its argument. But I'm going to suggest to you that that language, although true, it appears in the Tibiotowski opinion, comes in the analysis section and is not actually an articulation of what the test. If you back up in the Tibiotowski opinion and you see that what that's based on is two United States Supreme Court cases, both of which are mentioned in both briefs in this case. It's Mathis and Estelle. And in both of those cases, if you look at that, you'll see that.
So, counsel, I'm going to interrupt you just briefly. It looks like, Marshall, we forgot to start the timer.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
No,
I'm sorry.
That's all right. I'm glad you didn't notice it. It means our conversation's been good.
I'm sorry.
So, at this point, I'm a little bit at a loss.
Four
minutes have been used. Okay, very good.
Okay.
Go right ahead, counsel.
Thank you. Yes. So if you look at the two United States Supreme Court cases, Mathis and Estelle, and again, they're both in both briefs in this case, in neither of those cases did we have someone who was acting as a law enforcement officer, yet in both cases, the United States Supreme Court held that they were required to give Miranda. In Mathis, it was an IRS agent who was conducting a routine civil tax investigation. There was no suggestion that he was there working as a police officer, yet nonetheless, ultimately, the court concluded that a Miranda warning would have been required in that case because there was the, quote, possibility during his investigation that his work would end up in a criminal prosecution.
I wasn't clear if he was IRS CID.
I'm not clear on that either, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah. And while that may arguably have some law enforcement overlap there, too, if you look at Estelle, that clearly did not. Estelle had to do with a psychiatrist doing a court-ordered competency examination. And I want to read you a quote from the opinion there, which I think is particularly important, and that comes at page 467 of the opinion. The court said that when the doctor went beyond simply reporting to the court on the issue of competence and testified for the prosecution, his role changed and became essentially like that of an agent of the state recounting unwarned statements made in a post-arrest custodial setting. So that's really what we're looking at here, is we're looking at not whether the person was actually acting as a police officer. That's not the test. The test is, are they using the power of the state somehow to elicit an incriminating response from the defendant? And
so we have two statements here. We have the in-person custodial statement where she goes to the jail and interviews him. And then we have his letter that he sent later on. Are you saying that we should analyze those both under the same framework?
Yes, and I do think they were raised that way in the district court as well, because understand that this is essentially one ongoing interview or ongoing process, let me put it that way, because what happens is she comes to the jail to, under her statutory authority, she comes to the jail to interview him, and she does that in person, and he gives a statement to her.
On that subject, and before we get past that, on that subject, my reading of the record is he essentially told her what he had told the police in a Mirandized statement a couple weeks before that.
I would agree with you if you go to the ultimate conclusion of what he does is deny that he physically or sexually abused her. I would suggest to you that the record reflects that Ms. Gullickson's interview was much more detailed and went with some real precise questioning that didn't happen before.
But of course, if you end up saying, I didn't do any of that stuff, it doesn't matter how detailed the preceding questioning was.
And what the state wants you to believe is that looking at that oral statement that he gave in the jail in isolation, that there's no prejudice from that because he essentially denies that he does anything wrong.
What is the prejudice?
That's wrong. The state's argument I'm suggesting is wrong on that point because for two reasons. You don't look at it in isolation because you need to look at the whole context of what happened here. After he gave that statement, Ms. Gullickson continued her investigation in terms of interviewing witnesses, reviewing police reports, and so forth, and ultimately came to her determination that Mr. Muhammad had, in fact, physically and sexually assaulted CM. As part of her statutory authority and duty, she is then required to communicate the results of her investigation to him. She does this by the official findings letter when she notifies him that we have determined that you have committed physical and sexual abuse of a vulnerable adult. What that letter also then says to him is, if you disagree, you can do so in writing, and you have 15 days to do so. The letter notifies him of possible negative impacts that this determination is going to have and his right to request reconsideration. So then that's what, when faced with her confrontation that it has been determined you physically and sexually assaulted a vulnerable adult, he then responds in writing with a different version of events, which I can only imagine in his mind he thought was some kind of exculpatory statement giving a different version of events, but as we know from this record, it was highly inculpatory and used by the state to prove the elements of force, coercion, and penetration. I'm going back to the letter, if you can bear with me. The oral statement. The important part about that now, whereas back in time, in isolation, it may be true to say that it was simply a denial and therefore no prejudice. Remember, please, that what the state did with that in closing argument is say, look at his initial version of events, the oral statement, where he denied anything. Couple that with his written version of events, where he admitted things, he's an incredible witness. He's told inconsistent versions of this event, and you can't believe anything he says.
I think we need to move you to the written version, because that seems like where it all comes down. The state would have been able to compare the written version to the police officer's statement with the same effect.
I don't agree with that because, again, I would take you back to the difference between what was questioned at the time of the police statement and what was questioned at the time of the oral statement, because the police statement actually happens in time when he's been charged and he's only suspected at that point in time of misdemeanor domestic assault. And there's no conversation at all back in that point in time about any alleged sexual misconduct, because CM herself has not yet alleged that he did anything of a sexual nature to her. Now, when Ms. Gullickson speaks to him in the jail, those allegations have come out, and she asks him very pointed questions about sexual conduct between the two, which he denies. Now, keep in mind, too, the one other point I want to make for this court about looking at just the oral statement. Remember that for Miranda purposes, an incriminating statement for Miranda purposes is actually defined as any response, whether inculpatory or exculpatory, that the prosecution may seek to introduce into evidence at trial. So I just remind you that even if you want to try and think about the oral statement itself as somehow being exculpatory, that's still considered an incriminating statement for Miranda purposes. And to talk a little bit more about the letter and to help this court understand why I think that the official findings letter is interrogation, remember that, again, what it tells Mr. Muhammad is that a determination, an investigation, has led to the determination that you have physically and sexually abused this vulnerable adult. You've been warned about the negative impact this determination can have, and the letter expressly invites him to reply, to disagree in writing. Now, any reasonable person, when faced with that information, is going to respond. And certainly, in this case, where we've got Ms. Gullickson and her knowledge that Mr. Muhammad had previously denied any wrongdoing, she should know that he is going to respond to her official findings letter.
Doesn't she have a statutory duty to communicate those findings?
That's true, she does. But that doesn't mean that this isn't essentially interrogation for Miranda purposes. Because remember, for that, the standard is express questioning or its functional equivalent, meaning any words or actions on the part of police that the police know or should know are reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response.
But he, on June 2nd, was charged with first-degree crim sex.
Mm-hmm.
She sends a letter almost 2 weeks later on June 12th. And so whether or not he can get licensed to do whatever certainly pales in comparison to what would happen if he's convicted of crim sex.
Well, remember, too, that what we have here is somebody, Ms. Gullickson, who's working under her statutory authority to investigate these alleged criminal allegations of physical and sexual assault. She's required by her authority to consult and coordinate with the police investigation as well. She is required to share information with the police, and she, in fact, does so. When she receives this letter that Mr. Muhammad writes in response, she turns that over to the police. So there is an intertwining here of the investigation that's going on. I don't want this court to be under the misimpression that, as the district court seemed to rule, that what Ms. Gullickson was doing over here was in her civil statutory authority, completely independent of and divorced of any law enforcement investigation. As I've pointed out to you in the briefs, when you actually look at what her civil statutory duty and authority and obligation was, it's completely intertwined with her responsibility to consult, coordinate, and work with law enforcement on their investigation as well. And that's what she did in this case.
When did she communicate that letter to law enforcement?
I don't know. I don't remember from her testimony if she was specific about that. I do remember at trial she did confirm that she did turn it over.
Oh, yes.
But that was after he had already been charged.
Certainly after he'd been charged, but not before trial. And the point here for Miranda purposes is when this becomes problematic is when these are statements of the defendant that the prosecution seeks to introduce into evidence at trial. That's the key right there. I do have some other comments on this, but of course I'll save them till rebuttal as I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And respondent, we're ready for you when you're ready.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Nicholas Hajdukovic. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. I'd like to begin by also addressing the same issues counsel just did, the oral and written statements that the appellant made to the social worker in this matter. And I'd like to begin, first of all, I think with the oral statement and the harmless error analysis, because I think that there's a couple of clarifications that need to be made regarding the record on that. One is that, first of all, although there was more detail in the statement the appellant made to Ms. Gullickson than the sheriff's deputy, what matters for harmless error is what the jury actually heard. And what the jury heard, as I outlined in my brief, is that there was only a very small amount of what the appellant actually said to Ms. Gullickson that was actually admitted at the trial. That's at pages 354 to 355 of the transcript.
Can you say those pages again?
354 to 55.
Thank you.
And all that was asked of the social worker and all that she talked about at trial was that she interviewed the appellant at the Washington County Jail, and that in response to questioning, he said that he and the victim were friends and denied being in a romantic or sexual relationship with her. So for harmless error purposes, that's what matters. And that is fully duplicative of what the appellant told the sheriff's deputy in his Mirandized statement that was properly admitted, and there's no objection to the admission of that statement.
Was that a taped statement or just an oral statement?
The statement to the sheriff's deputy was recorded, and that...
Was?
Yes.
Scales tape.
Yes, and it was that recording was played for the jury at trial as well. The statement to Ms. Gullickson was recorded, but the recording wasn't played at trial. It was just those few brief questions about what he said.
Thank you.
So it's...
demonstrates that there was a high level of coordination between Ms. Gullickson and the police in this investigation.
Well, what I would say to that is two things. First of all, there was a degree of coordination, and as counsel indicated, it's statutorily required. But as to the statement from the appellant, there wasn't a degree of coordination. The sheriff's deputy got the Mirandized statement first. The appellant waived his Miranda rights and agreed to speak and denied any wrongdoing. And then the social worker came back and interviewed him several days later, and the appellant obviously wasn't read his Miranda rights, but spoke with her and basically said the same thing, at least in terms of what the jury heard. Now, there is good reason to believe, that in terms of what the record in this case shows, that there wasn't a high degree of coordination as to the statement from the appellant. And that's, I think, first and foremost, is the what we can look at in terms of how this statement even came to light. The parties weren't even aware that this audio recording existed until the appellant made a motion pursuant to State v. Parity to have the district court review in camera the social services file in the case. And the district court did so and happened upon this statement that apparently had not been shared with law enforcement or the prosecutor. And the district court didn't even realize that it was a separate statement from the statement to the sheriff's deputy until inquiring of the parties about it. And then the parties realized, oh, there's another recorded statement out there that we didn't even know about. That's in the contested omnibus transcripts is where that's detailed. I think that pretty amply demonstrates that as to that statement, getting the statement from the appellant in jail, that there wasn't apparently any coordination. And I think that actually makes sense if you look at it in the full context of how these things work. Certainly, we both with young children and vulnerable adults, there's a desire to minimize the number of interviews of a victim or a potential victim of abuse. And so you would expect, as happened here, the law enforcement and social services to try to minimize that and do the interviews together or just do one interview and rely on that for both law enforcement and social worker purposes. But then eventually those, I think their purposes are going to diverge a bit. The social worker is completing a maltreatment investigation, but part of that is ensuring statutorily that the vulnerable adult is safe, that they're getting the required services, medical care, whatever they might need to help them. Whereas law enforcement can continue more along the lines of, was there a crime committed, who committed it, and how can we gather evidence of it? So I think by this point, their paths have diverged quite a bit, just logically in terms of how these investigations work. So that's my, I guess my...
That omnibus hearing held in relation to the sending of the vulnerable adult findings letter?
It was after. The vulnerable adult findings letter was sent in, was sent in June. I want to say June 11th or thereabouts.
Was that disclosed to police at the time it was sent?
I don't know if the findings letter was disclosed to police. I know that when the social worker received the appellant's written statement back from him, that she provided that to the police.
Okay, and when was that in relation to the Parity hearing?
It was, I guess I don't know the exact date she gave it to the police, but it was, I think, probably well before the...
Before the
Parity. Yes, it was before the Parity hearing for sure. Because the parties were aware of the letter at that point. Now, we also disagree, counsel and I guess disagree on what exactly the test is here for when a person who's not a police officer is interviewing somebody in custody. And I think that's maybe partially because the test is not necessarily entirely clear. But in Tibiotowski, at pages 310 through 311 of its opinion, the Supreme Court says that our test for whether the respondent was subjected to the interrogation the Supreme Court sought to protect him from under Miranda is whether it was first, quote, questioning initiated by law enforcement officers, citing Miranda, and second, one, whether under a totality of circumstances it would be reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response, citing Innes. And the court then goes on to say immediately after that Wheeler, the caseworker who asked the questions in that case, was not acting as a law enforcement officer at the time. So I think that
the facts that she was seeking are so different than what Gullickson was seeking in this case. As I understand, Tibiotowski was juvenile. She was a caseworker concerned about where he was staying, mm-hmm. his welfare.
And I agree that the facts are not particularly similar between the two cases, but I'm just trying to articulate what the test is. And I think there may be some disagreement about what the test is among various courts. And in fact, counsel cited some cases from other jurisdictions that actually use somewhat different tests. But Tibiotowski is obviously binding here. And so just in terms of the test that's used and how we apply it is another question, obviously. But I think that is the test. They're quoting Miranda, so they're getting it directly from the Miranda decision, whether the person is questioning initiated by law enforcement officers. So then we have to determine who is a law enforcement officer. So there is language in some cases about anybody using the power of the state to elicit a statement or something to that effect. But I think that is more of the overarching principle. I think the actual test, at least in Minnesota, is the language straight out of Tibiotowski. So that's what I'm asking the court to apply here. Again, if the court even needs to reach the merits of the oral statement in particular, which I would submit that it does not, because I think it's about as clear-cut of a case as harmless error, honestly, as you can find. What I would also note then about the...
Did he have appointed counsel by the time of the vulnerable adult letter?
By the time of the letter, I believe he would have, yes. It was sent around June 10th or 11th, if I recall correctly, and he was charged, I believe, June 1st or 2nd. And so he was in jail and presumably had counsel appointed. I'd have to double check the record, but I believe so.
Well, he had been arrested for misdemeanor domestic assault. And on May 22nd, Tina Gullickson went and interviewed him.
Correct. Correct. And then the letter was sent in June is what I was referring to, I believe, because that's when she completed her investigation. But I don't think there's there was no Sixth Amendment issue raised. But I also don't think that, even if it were, I don't think counsel would prevail on it because of the fact that the letter was simply not interrogation. Obviously, it's interrogation only if it's reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. And
appellant argues with some persuasiveness that it was reasonably likely to elicit a response that you could use.
Well, what I would say to that is, first of all, that it's not reasonably likely. I don't think any reasonable person, especially a police officer or social worker, would expect that by sending a form letter saying, we have determined that you committed maltreatment and you can seek reconsideration by essentially notifying Washington County of your request for that, that they would, in effect, get to that basically a confession. It has to be incriminating statements.
Statements that are used in an incriminating fashion, the details of how it was incriminating isn't so terribly important for this analysis.
Well, I think that is true, but I don't think it's, if anything, it's reasonably likely, if it's likely to elicit any factual response in terms of the substantive facts of the given case, it would be exculpatory statements, because why would a person seek reconsideration by admitting to a crime? I mean, obviously, that's essentially what the appellant did here, but the question is the reasonableness of that, whether a reasonable social worker should have foreseen something like this coming.
And I'm struggling a little bit with that argument from you, counsel, in part because of the content of the letter. So the findings letter does state at the bottom, and I'm sure you're right, it's just a form letter, but it says, if you do not agree with the county lead investigative agency's determination, you may ask, and I'm going to skip a few words, to reconsider its determination. Your request for reconsideration must be submitted in writing within 15 calendar days, and it goes on. I'm sure you know the language. So doesn't that invite a response? I hear your argument to say it doesn't invite a confession, but is that really the question?
I think that it's not reasonably likely to invite an incriminating response.
Because you don't think a reasonable person would confess?
Not if they're asking them to change their mind about maltreatment, no. I think that's completely unreasonable for someone to see coming. And it doesn't ask for any factual response, first of all. It doesn't actually ask for any facts. It just says, you can ask us to reconsider. So it doesn't say tell us why or anything like that as an initial matter. But what I would ask the court to do, too, is to compare the facts here to those of the Innis case. Because I would submit that, frankly, the facts of Innis are, in some ways rather egregious, and that there Innes was arrested after an armed robbery with a gun. Police hadn't found the gun. They're driving him back to the police station, and the police start talking to each other about, boy, there's handicapped kids who lived in this area, and wouldn't it just be awful if those kids happened to cross the gun and, you know, something terrible happened? And naturally, he said, okay, I'll show you where the gun is. And the Supreme Court said that was not reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. Now, you can disagree with that, but that's what the U.S. Supreme Court said. And if that's not reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response, I can't fathom how this form letter that doesn't actually ask for anything and it just provides information statutorily required is.
I'm going to follow up on Judge Brotfeld's question. I'm looking at his response to that form letter.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't confess to a crime.
No.
To the contrary, what he does is say it was voluntary sexual activity and make a statement contrary to his earlier statement denying any sexual activity, which is incriminating in context despite it not being a confession.
Well, that's true. I was probably overstating it by calling it a confession. I think you're right about that. But I also...
Only incriminating in context.
Right.
Say, if he hadn't denied it earlier, and his response to the letter was, jeepers, we were having voluntary sexual intercourse, and I didn't know that she was a vulnerable adult.
But
that's
not incriminating. But at the very least, it is a confession to a physical assault, if nothing else, when he talks about punching her and things like that. The other thing I'm sorry?
It was horseplay.
Well, right, I guess. But I think that if we look at this through the lens of a reasonable person and what a reasonable person would expect, I don't think any reasonable person would expect a response like that. And the other thing I'd like the court to look at with regard to the letter is there's sort of two prongs to this issue, and the second is, again, whether she was acting in the capacity of law enforcement under Tibiotowski. And I think that once we've moved to the letter, it becomes even more clear she wasn't. She was doing exactly what a social worker is statutorily required to do, and it seems wholly divorced from any police investigation at that point. She doesn't have a choice but to send this letter. I don't know what reasonable argument there is at this point that when she sends that letter with her findings that she is acting as a law enforcement officer for Miranda purposes. So even if the court thinks that this may be interrogation under Innes, she's still not acting as a law enforcement officer under Tibiotowski when she sends that letter. So for those reasons, I would ask that the court affirm the appellant's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And appellant, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, 2 points I'd like to make on rebuttal. The first is to address this idea that the official findings letter was not reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response because it, as the state argues in its brief and mentioned here today in comments, that the letter itself does not request any information or explicitly ask Mr. Muhammad to tell his version of events. I suggest to you very respectfully that that's an absurd premise, because if we play that out, what the state's essentially arguing there is that what the letter advises Mr. Muhammad is, if you disagree with our determination that you physically and sexually abused this vulnerable adult, you may disagree, you may ask for reconsideration, do it in writing. What the state's suggesting is that all Mr. Muhammad would do then is respond with, I request you reconsider, period. And say nothing more. Well, of course, if an agency is faced with that kind of a statement, what are they going to do? They're not going to reconsider. They're going to ask why. A reconsideration is only going to happen, and a different result is only going to come from this if they're provided with new and different information that they did not have before they came to their initial determination. It would be like if a criminal defendant came before this court and said, I appeal my conviction, period. Is this court going to reverse? No, of course not. You need to know why. What is the information that I need to have to come to a decision that's different than the one that's already been made? That's why, in this case, this official findings letter is clearly reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. And again, incriminating can mean either inculpatory or exculpatory statements. They're statements that the prosecution seeks to use against the defendant at trial. The second point I want to bring up is about Tibiotowski, and I do agree with counsel to the extent that we essentially agree to disagree about what the proper test is, and I think the language from Tibiotowski is difficult. I'm sure counsel and I both have spent a significant time rereading the opinion and trying to parse it out, and I'm sure this court will too. But what I'd like to bring you back to is remember that in Tibiotowski, the before the language that the state relies on, we also have the language of the court recognizing the controlling authority of Estelle, the U.S. Supreme Court case. And in Estelle, again, that case did not involve someone who was acting as a law enforcement officer. That can't possibly be the test, because the whole question here is we're dealing with somebody who is not, by definition, a police officer. So it's absurd to suggest that the test is, well, are they a police officer? No. The whole reason we're having this debate is because they're not. But even if this court does think that there has to be some kind of law enforcement aspect to the questioner's duties, I'd suggest to you that here that's amply established, because what Ms. Gullickson had was the power of the state under state statute, as cited to you in the brief, that to enforce the laws protecting vulnerable adults. That was her whole purpose here. Her statutory authority and her duty are derived from this power to enforce the laws of the state of Minnesota to protect and carry out the policy of protecting vulnerable adults. So even if you do think there needs to be some kind of law enforcement capacity here, I'd suggest to you that law enforcement broadly does cover exactly what Ms. Gullickson was doing in this case. So for these reasons that we've talked about today, and I'd like to again remind you that the issue is not just the statements in isolation. It's the oral statement, the written statement by Mr. Muhammad together, how they're used by the state in closing argument to undermine his credibility, and clearly the letter standing alone is highly incriminating. And the state, I would remind this court, did not advance a harmless error argument with respect to the letter. So the state essentially concedes that with respect to Mr. Muhammad's written admissions here, there's no harmless error argument that can be made. So if this court were to determine that, in fact, the district court erred in its suppression ruling here, that Ms. Gullickson was required to give a Miranda warning, and that Mr. Muhammad's written response is the product of interrogation, it was prejudicial, and we ask the court to reverse Mr. Muhammad's convictions. Thank you.
The court's thanks to both counsel in this case. The matter was well briefed and well argued. It's now submitted to the court for its decision, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you. Thank you.